This program is brought to you by the Kentucky Women Writers Conference on iTunes U at the University of Kentucky in Lexington. For more information on the conference and to access our complete audio archive, visit us online at KentuckyWomenWriters.org.
Thanks, Julie. I'm really happy to be here. I love this conference, and I love being involved. And I'm really happy today to introduce Susan Stewart, who is a poet that I greatly admire and have actually written about. Susan comes to us from Princeton, where she is Avalon Foundation Professor in the Humanities. She's published 5 books of poetry and 5 books of criticism. I think that's correct. And has a book forthcoming that I've been looking forward to called The Poet's Freedom, a notebook on making. Am I right about that? And that's coming out in, is it November? Or yes. She's also published a collection of translations of the Italian poet Aldo Marini and other translations and writing as well, and has won many, many awards. Some of the things that I love about Stewart's work and that I find especially inspiring and heartening are these: structural variety, inventiveness, idiosyncrasy, compassion. I've written a long essay on her, so I'll try to say this plainly. She's one of the poets who, along with Elizabeth Bishop and Emily Dickinson, has enabled me, and I'm guessing others like myself, to feel okay about not fitting into current styles and trends, to feel supported by her example, to pursue our own ways of making poems and of making art. Poetry can be beautiful, it can be terrifying, it can be honest, it can be strengthening, it can call upon us to discover our better selves. Stewart's work proves it. So join me in welcoming Susan Stewart.
Thank you, Lisa. That was just an introduction I'll always remember. And I've had a very memorable day. It's just been such a pleasure. It's all kind of gone by in a flash, and I'm sure I'm more tired than I feel. So if I start not making sense, just let me know. I'm going to read for, I guess, about 35 minutes. And I thought I would read from early work and recent work. Can you all hear me if I speak like this and you're not getting too much feedback or anything? Okay. This is a poem, the title poem from my book, The Forest. The Forest. You should lie down now and remember the forest, for it is disappearing. No, the truth is it is gone now, and so what details you can bring back might have a kind of life. Not the one you had hoped for, but a life. You should lie down now and remember the forest. Nonetheless, you might call it in the forest. No, the truth is, it is gone now, starting somewhere near the beginning, that edge, or instead the first layer, the place you remember, not the one you had hoped for, but a life. As if it were firm underfoot, for that place is a sea, nonetheless you might call it in the forest, which we can never drift above, we were there or we were not. No surface skimming. And blank in life too, or instead the first layer, the place you remember, as layers fold in time, black humus there, as if it were firm underfoot, for that place is a sea, like a light left hand descending always on the same keys. The flecked birds of the forest sing behind and before, no surface skimming, and blank in life too, sing without a music where there cannot be an order. As layers fold in time, black humus there, where wide swatches of light slice between gray trunks, where the air has a texture of drying moss. The flecked birds of the forest sing behind and before, a musk from the mushrooms and scalloped molds. They sing without a music where there cannot be an order, though high in the dry leaves something does fall, nothing comes down to us here. Where the air has a texture of drying moss. In that place where I was raised, the forest was tangled, a musk from the mushrooms and scalloped molds. tangled with brambles, soft-starred and moving, ferns, and the marred twines of cinquefoil, false strawberry, sumac. Nothing comes down to us here, stained. A low branch swinging above a brook, in that place where I was raised, the forest was tangled, and a cave just the width of shoulder blades. You can understand what I am doing when I think of the entry and the marred twines of cinquefoil, false strawberry, sumac, as a kind of limit. Sometimes I imagine us walking there, pokeberry stained, a low branch swinging above a brook, in a place that is something like a forest. But perhaps the other kind, where the ground is covered, you can understand what I am doing when I think of the entry, by pliant green needles, there below the piney fronds, a kind of limit. Sometimes I imagine us walking there, and quickening below lie the sharp brown blades, the disfiguring blackness, then the bulb phosphorescence of the roots. But perhaps the other kind, where the ground is covered, so strangely alike and yet singular too, below the pliant green needles, the piney fronds. Once we were lost in the forest, so strangely alike and yet singular too, but the truth is, it is lost to us now. Well, that's all I'm going to read from that book, I'm sorry. But I thought I would turn, we were talking a little bit about in the workshops about Georgics, and my book Columbarium is structured as a book of Georgics, books of instruction, but they're Georgics of doubt, I think. They're poems about instructions in doubt. So I'll read a couple of the poems from here. The Georgic abecedarium in this book is flanked by poems about the four elements, which I originally made as an artist's book with my friend Enid Mark. So this is the poem on air. Sung from the generation of air, or vacancy, what memory can sing before there is memory, a breath sent into being before a being draws in and out its breath. In darkness, when being confettied is not yet mote, not beam, not remnant of cloud, a thin thread of motion gathering weight in weightless space. Their loneliness leaned into nothing, fell into the world, and was the first of all things falling toward falling. How the stillness turned and whistled, and the whistle was in the wind, and a pod released and rattled, flew spilled, then filled with air. A part of air, an urgency, a boundary made by bursting, what we call the winding of the wind. The ear is a drum and cavern that will not close against the world, and so we build our houses where the wind cannot enter at will. Blow the house down, stall the ship. The wind, our enemy, runs toward us in the night or withholds at daybreak for days on end. I woke to wonder, what if the wind were evil, the force of an incessant pain? Unbind, unwind the four winds, without them no direction. Yet air is the element most bearable to every mortal thing. The flight. Snatched away, the paper lands flat at first, clings to the cement, the smooth side friction locked to the pitted surface for a second, then lifted by a corner, then swirling, then dipping, flush against the steel of a car door. Then flying off toward a branch, snagged, unsnagged, sailing. On one side, the answers were traced so carefully, capitals and small letters, peaks and valleys, a black pen tacking between the blue lines. Forget the answers, and then the test, and then the paper, and then the sidewalk, and then the tree, and then the sky. This is the order of forgetting, the one you already know by heart. It is neither evil nor good, as things are neither here nor there when they fly. Whisper. A whisper within an ordinary parting, a sigh nesting in a word. It comes inside another breeze, warmer, softly, to touch your cheek or shoulder, lighting down, as down does, and doesn't, and does again. What was it? You will ask yourself, and you will ask again, until asking itself is like a caress. Nothing, then something, and nothing again, there in the clear as day. But something, something meant. What was it? And this you'll probably recognize is from the fifth canto of Dante's Inferno, the memory of happiness in a time of misery. Like starlings in winter, the wind beating against their beating wings, the air numb and mutely blank, a whiteness tumbling, the dead leaves, they too whirled like dead leaves, torqued one way then another for the sake of each other, even in death joined by their scattered dove-like gliding, two heads bowed above a page, the lamp sputtered, flickered, sparked in the deafening silence, the ear is a drum, a cavern that will not close against the voice of the beloved, and the eye has a door that can bar a whirlwind, a sanctuary shut to its harm. Scirocco, hot dust breaking in the mouth, dumb the tongue mute to reason cause, an eye held open to see not seeing, furled the thought dried to powdery sense, one way then another for the sake of each other, even in death joined by mistaken heaven's playthings, God's needless mindless of consequence, three heads bowed above a page, an olive strip bare of its silver and a hill strip bare of its tree, barren random, an iron lung bellowing, a dark cup thrown into the flames, draw a clearing around the heart so it might breathe freely again. The survival of Icarus. My father saw the feathers on the waves and grieved, and hadn't heard the voice within the wind that blew the wax back into form the way the cold dawn shapes the candle's foam. I had heard that voice before in some far time beyond this place, and I think of it now as a living net, though I do not know how it spans our world or if it sings from its strings or its spaces. Listen. In a golden field alone, lone, the quick dust whirling, hurling, eyes burning, earning, burning tears, where air was the other, gone one and unknowing. No one, nay, could answer. Crying, ring. There in desolation, solation. Forgotten, gotten. Forsaken, saken. For pity, pity. Forbear, be air. Now I could use a drink of water. Let me see if I can. Poems about dust make you thirsty. You'll see. Okay, I'd like to read a poem that's a bit more cheerful. This is one of the Georgics. It's called Apple. Maybe it doesn't sound cheerful when I start it, but it is. Apple. If I could come back from the dead, I would come back for an apple. And just for the first bite, the first break, and the cold, sweet grain against the roof of the mouth, as plain and clear as water. Some apple names are almost forgotten, and the apples themselves are gone. The smokehouse, wine sap, and York Imperial, the striped summer Rambo, and the winter banana, the little Rome with its squat rotunda, and the pound apple that pulled the boughs to the ground. The sheep's nose with its three-pointed snout, the blue pearmain speckled and sugared, Grimes golden, Cortland, and stamen. If an apple's called delicious, it's not. Water has no substance, and soil has no shell. Sun is all process, and rain cannot rise. The apple's core carries a birth and a poison, stem and skin and flesh and seed. The apple's name, no matter, is work and the work of death. If you wait for the apple, you wait for one ripe moment. And should you sleep, or should you dream, or should you stare too hard in the daylight, or come into the dark to see what can't be seen, you will drop from the edge, going over into coarse, or rot, or damping off. You will wake to yourself regretful in a grove of papery leaves. You need a hillside, a small and steady wind, a killing frost, and later, honeybees. You need a shovel and shears and a ladder, and the balance to come back down again. You will have fears of coddling moths and railroad worms and aphids. Scale and maggots and beetles will come to do their undoing. Forests will trap the air, and valleys will bend to gales. Cedars will bring on rust, so keep them far in the distance. Paradise, of course, was easy, but you and I live in this world, and the fruit of the tree in the midst of the garden says nothing specific about apples. The apples of golden proverbs are probably oranges instead, and so are the fruits millennium threw down, an apple does not glitter. If you're interested in immortality, it's best to plant a tree, and even then you can't be sure that form will last under weather. The tree can break apart in a storm or be torqued into pieces over many years from the weight of its ruddy labor. The state won't let you burn the wood in the open air. The smoke is too dense for breathing. But applewood makes a lovely fire with excellent heat and aroma. Fire will take in whatever it can, and heat will draw back into earth. Here is the fruit, your reward and penalty at once, said the god to the waiting figures. Unbearable the world that broke into time, unbearable the just born certainty of distance. You can roast late apples in the ashes, you can run them in slices on a stick. You can turn the stem to find the letter of your love, or chase them down with your chin in a tub. If you count the seeds to tell the future, your heart will sense more than your tongue can say. A body has a season, though it may not know it, and damage will bloom in beauty's seed. If I could come back from the dead, I would. I'd come back for an apple. And just for one bite, one break, and the cold, sweet grain on the tongue. There is so little difference between an apple and a kiss, between desire and the taste of desire. Anyone who tells you otherwise is a liar, as bad as a snake in the quiet grass. You can watch out for the snake and the lie, but the grass, the green, green wave of it, there below the shadows of the black and twisted boughs, will not be what you thought it would be. You know, Auden said that poetry makes nothing happen, but that poem brought me a wonderful thing. I went to my office one day, and there was a package, and someone from upstate who had an orchard of antique apples sent me a box with every kind of apple that I mentioned in the poem. So the great thing was knowing not only what I was going to have to eat for lunch for the rest of the month, but also that those apples do exist. They haven't gone extinct. Okay, well, I think I'll read a little bit from my book Red Rover, and then I'll read some new poems. I find I'm distracted by having these books here. I think I'll read these two poems. Well, actually, this poem has a sequence of games from children, including the title poem, so I'll read a couple of those. Maybe you know some of these games. It's been really hard for my translator because these are American and English children's games, and they're just not translatable, so they have to be called by their title. This one is My Mother's Garden. My Mother's Garden. I lost my copper key in my mother's garden. I lost my silver knife staring at a cloud. I found my wooden boat hiding in the rushes. I found my wishing stone hiding in my shoe. I lost my copper key hiding in the rushes. I found my wooden boat staring at a cloud. I lost my memory when I learned to whistle. If you find my silver knife, hide it in a stone. Shadow play. I made a fist and it grew two ears, long ears with a mumbling mouth. Then I opened my hand, it grew four feathers, and another hand rose to meet it. And two thumbs made a double dove's beak, curving and nodding on the windless white. One four-fingered wing swinging out, the other feathering in. Blackbirds in my bedroom wall, blackbirds flying faster than the arc of headlights emerging from the road beyond the window, looming and emptying, looming, then emptying, then looming, then emptying the room of all its light. Red Rover. Red Rover, Red Rover, let them come over. Red planet, red star, attacking, attaching. Come over, war against love, overcome. And come over, Red Rover, let them come over. Pleaser, permitter, decider, old teaser, spirit moving formless through the startled leaves. Come over, come over, as you stood there shouting and waiting, over, come over, your arms linked inside, come over, the long shadows. You knew the other view would come in time, and be like time, silent and waiting. Though first your name, let your own name come over, would have to tack across that no man's land between the lines and come over. So when it came in a chorus sudden and strange, like an offering that drew you on with all its glitter, it hardly seemed it could be yours, and you looked around to see if someone else were meant. But then you were running, running toward them, struggling to break them or reaching to join them. In the end, it would turn out the same. Exclusion, inclusion, small changes of perspective. That was how you first met the God of permissions, who has no face or figure, who never lingers in our image. But you didn't know that yet. Someone would twist and fall, crying. The sun dropped, vanished, a scraped dish, a screen door slap, and one by one, fireflies, the mother's voice is lighting, calling her name, come in, then his, come in, and yours at last, you knew at once, come in, come in, come in and in, though soon, in a dream again, you were running, running toward them, struggling and reaching, reaching, beseeching, if you can, if you can't, by a hickory limb. The future came wearing the look of the past, and a spirit roved restless through the shaken leaves. So I'll read one more poem from this book. This is the first poem in it, The Owl. Two nights ago we were kept awake by a screech owl that was really clearly a screech owl. So this poem is a bit more mysterious. The owl. I thought somehow a piece of cloth was tossed into the night. A piece of cloth that flew up, then across beyond the window. A tablecloth or handkerchief, a knot somehow unfolding, folded, pushing through the thickness of the dark. I thought somehow a piece of cloth was lost beyond the line, released, although it seemed as if a knot still hung unfolding. Some human hand could not have thrown that high, or lent such force to cloth. And yet I knew no God would mind a square of air so small. And still it moved, and still it swooped and disappeared beyond the pane. The after image went, a blot beyond the icy glass. And closer there stood winter grass, so black it had no substance, until I looked again and saw it tipped with brittle frost. An acre there, a commonplace, a line of trees, a line of stars. So look it up, you'll find that you could lose your sense of depth. A leaf, a sheaf of paper, pillowcase, or heart-shaped face. A shrieking hiss, like winds, like death, all tangled there in branches. I called this poem The Owl, the name that, like a key, locked out the dark, and later let me close my book and sleep a winter dream. And yet the truth remains that I can't know just what I saw. And if it comes each night, each dream, each star, or not at all, it's not, it's never evident that waiting has no reason. The circuit of the world belies the chaos of its forms, the kind of thing astronomers look down to write in books. And still I thought a piece of cloth had flown outside my window, or human hands had freed a wing, or churning gods revealed themselves, or greater news, a northern owl, a snowy owl, descended. Okay. I have a few new poems, and some of them are narrative poems. I thought I would read two of them. But first, I'd like to enlist you in a project I have, which is that I want to get rid of mandatory television across the United States. Television in jury rooms, televisions everywhere. And I was complaining about this to my children when we pulled into a gas station the summer before last, and there were televisions on the gas pumps, and I couldn't believe it. So I want, like all poets in America, to write poems on bumper stickers and put them across the televisions on gas pumps. So this is my start. These are four inscriptions for gas pump TVs. Midway the forest certain parts its dark curtain. Ride into the sunrise, the future roars from the passing lane. A dividing line binds the shook. Where are you going, cleaner? Tears travel seawards. How do you like their driving? I don't know, I think they're funny, but I think you have to have them on the gas pumps and stare at them for a while or something. Okay. I've been having fun writing narrative poems. This one is based on a French novel that many people, probably like many of you like me, had to read in high school called Devil in the Flesh, which I found very sexy and interesting. So this is called Piano Music for a Silent Movie. The gossips whisper their reproaches. Was it my fault I was too young for the war? A muddy rain spoils every picnic, but the fields are thirsty, the farmers are poor. My talent lies in kissing and pretending and climbing barefoot up a trellis in the dark. The neighbors are sharpening their pitchforks, though no one dares to tell us. In the park, I found her note pinned to a linden, her hair ribbon snagged in a pine. All the world worries a lover when all the world seems like a sign. I crossed the weedy river and floated along to her door. She promised me a portrait of the roses, Forever Pearl and Malakoff's Tour, Gloire de Dijon and Maréchal, the souvenir of Malmaison. I promised her nothing but trouble. My etre had no raison. Her hens pecked the grain from my pockets. Her cat ate the butter fat. You needed a coupon for coffee, so I brought her some cherries in my hat. She stowed her watercolors in the rowboat. I threw my books in the stern. The oars dripped blue across our shoes, and we banked in a bed of ferns. The crazy maid shattered the porch roof while the merry-go-round never stopped. Cannon pounded in the distance, or was it thunder? Every ear felt the pop. As for us, we were always falling, deeper than the tides and the moon, deeper than the quarry and the well and the shadows that hide at noon. All this frenzy set the cocks a-crowing. She let me pick the table and the chair. The olive wood glowed to embers. She let me let down her hair. I kissed his ear and his elbow, she sang, in the silky side of his thigh. I kissed his knees, I kissed his lips, and then he waved goodbye. Our little spirit flitted as fast and light as a moth. Shameful, they said, unlawful, a troth in the end is a troth. Love is a lapse and lovers liars. The father weeps, the mother sighs. The wagons are circling below the bedroom floor. One laughs too much, the other cries. The honeysuckle lost its honey, and the hens took their grain indoors. Frost leveled the ferny banks, and ice grew thick on the oars. I saw her face in the water. I saw his face in the glass. Some of us live in the present, and some of us live in the past. But it's the boot blacks marching toward the future who trample the summer grass. The gossips whisper their reproaches. Was it my fault I was too young for the war? A muddy rain spoils every picnic, but the fields are thirsty, the farmers are poor. And this poem is called A Language. It has in it the a mention of the Polish writer, the novelist Gombrowicz. I had heard the story before about the two prisoners alone in the same cell, and one gives the other lessons in a language. Day after day, the pupil studies hard. What else does he have to do? And year after year, they practice, waiting for the hour of release. They tackle the nouns, the cases, and genders, the rules for imperatives and conjugations. But near the end of his sentence, the teacher suddenly dies, and only the pupil goes back through the gate and into the open world. He travels to the country of his new language, fluent and full of hope. Yet when he arrives, he finds that the language he speaks is not the language that is spoken. He has learned a language one other person knew, its inventor, his cellmate, and teacher. And then the other evening, I heard the story again. This time the teacher was Gombrowicz, the pupil was his wife. She had dreamed of learning Polish, and hour after hour, for years on end, Gombrowicz had been willing to teach her a Polish that does not and never did exist. The man who told the story would like to marry his girlfriend. They love to read in bed, and between them speak three languages. They laughed at the wife, at Gombrowicz. It wasn't clear, and I wasn't sure that they themselves knew what was funny. I wondered why the man had told the story and thought of the tricks enclosure can play. A nod or silence, another nod, consent, or not as a cloud drifts beyond the scene and the two stand pointing in different directions at the very same empty sky. Even so, there was something else about the story, like teaching a stunt to an animal. A four-legged creature might prance on two legs, or a two-legged creature might fall onto four. I remembered then the miscarriage, and before that the months of waiting. Like baskets filled with bright shapes, the imagination run wild. And then what arrived, the event that was nothing, a mistaken idea, a scrap of charred cloth, the enormous present folding over the future, like a wave overtaking a grain of sand. There was a myth I once knew about twins who spoke a private language. The one spoke only the truth, and the other only lies. The savior gets mixed up with the traitor, but the traitor stays as true to himself as a god. All night the rain falls here, falls there, and the creatures dream or drown in the lair. And I'll just read one more poem. In the dark. In the dark, I thought, why do I love the truth? Invisible as thirst or gravity's pull, far sweeter than revenge or justice, even peace, which is not beyond the door, but is the door. The truth that drives the nail straight, though not within the nail, not within the wood. Truth as clear and blue as the sky. Some say true blue, right as rain, cross my heart and hope to die. You cannot hammer the truth into a person or turn your wrist and use the claw to pry it out. You cannot pound a nail into the sky. The truth is there as resistance and here as blue to repeat. As the sky, as blue and clear over all as the sky. Truth drives the stars straight into the dark, beyond gravity, beyond every grave. I awoke in the light and thought with a start of how I love the truth and why. In the dark I thought, why do I love the truth? Invisible as thirst or gravity's pull, far sweeter than revenge or justice, even peace, which is not beyond the door, but is the door. Thank you.
Susan is happy and ready to answer questions if you all have questions for her.
The issue of what I'm saying?
Length.
Oh, length, yeah.
Is it kind of intuitive, or do you find it?
Well, it completely has to do with the poem, individual poem. I mean, in a book, I try to have a relationship between short lyric sequences and kind of anchoring longer poems. Some poems, long poems, can be read out loud. I made the mistake. The King of the Hill is a double sestina. And I've heard John Ashbery read his famous double sestina, The Sunflower, right after he wrote it. It was very beautiful to listen to him read it, but I can't read that poem at once. It's just, and I think it's too much for people to listen to. And other poems I've written I won't read out loud because they become distorted by being read out loud. For example, a poem I have about slaughter in my book, The Forest, and my elegy for the massacre of the Amish girls, I won't read those poems out loud because they're meant to be read silently. That's not really what you asked me, but that was your opening question was that. A double sestina tells you how long it has to be. Other poems, you have to make a decision. We brought that up a lot in the workshop, with your poem too. Yeah.
In our workshop, we were, looking at the line, and we looked at one of your poems, and I can't
remember. Happiness No Time Misery, is that what you're thinking?
Yeah, that one.
Oh, that's from, I read the air.
Right, and when, we were looking at it, we were wondering how, what does this sound like, or how are we supposed to read it, and, I noticed that you read it very quickly, because I think, we were sort of, reading it more slowly, and sort of in and out. I was just wondering, it's like how you decide how to read a poem, and it's like what goes into that, basically.
Well, the only reason to give a reading or to come to a reading is to hear how a poet hears the poems himself or herself, and that air sequence, I have a really clear sense of it, almost like a musical piece, that parts are allegro and parts are lento. But the great thing about a book is you can read it at any pace you like. And I recognize that you can't really grasp what I'm saying when I'm reading it in that breathless way, but I just wanted the idea of Paola and Francesco being buffeted by the wind and being out of breath. So I learned to read it quickly. I can read it even faster than that when I haven't had a day of activity. But it's kind of fun, to do it. It doesn't mean you can't read it slowly later. I'd be grateful if you did. It's okay. Yeah.
I was trained as a visual artist, so I picked up this book of poetry, the most recent one, because of the way you visually have them on the page. What was the inspiration for that visual page? Or is it more, like you were saying, the rhythm and how it's read?
Well, it's not a contest. I mean, I care really a lot about both the visual effects of my poems and also the way they sound. I mean, that's one of the great things about poetry, is you can use imagery and even care about the way the poem looks on the page, in addition to the sound. I also have had a lot of training when I was young as a visual artist, and in recent years I've learned to do printmaking of various kinds, and I like visual art a lot and write about it a lot, so it's just part of my interest, I'd say. I also have more visual memories than oral memories, I would say, so when I write about the past, it's pretty vivid visually. Yeah.
I just wanted to make a comment that I thought your gas pump poems were very funny.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you. Are you going to make some yourself, is the question. Yeah.
I love the way the use of repetition and rhyme, not always applied regularly, but there, through the poem, moves the energy of the poem forward.
Thank you.
Thanks. And it's unusual. Mm-hmm. It's not something that you hear often.
Oh.
In fact, I have often used repetition and been warned against it by some of my readers.
Well, I think when you have a rule, somebody gives you a rule, it's really, if you're serious about being an artist, that's really, go right in there and break it. That's the most important thing you can do. I mean, I used to make a joke at my students, I'll never write a poem about fountains in Italy or something. But of course, that's exactly what I should be writing poems about if I feel that's a rule. So I think that rhyme and repetition, meter, those are parts of our most archaic pleasure in poetry as a species and also as individuals, and when they're it's gonna come back into your work, no matter what. Lately, I've been having fun really using rhyme in a very playful, obvious way. But otherwise, I think it's just going to come in subtly. I heard this wonderful thing that from a neurolinguist that when you think of a word, your brain kind of lights up with all the words that rhyme with that word. And I know I have that trouble even if I'm writing a memo or something like that. I'm suddenly starting to rhyme and I have to, it doesn't look very serious, so I have to go through and edit it out. Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's just part of our makeup. It's how we learn, in part. But, but it's important to give children lots of opportunities to do that, I think. I'm so heartened because when I teach meter to my students in recent years, you know, I always start with Anglo-Saxon stress meter, and in recent years I've been distressed that very few of them know any nursery rhymes. And last week when I was teaching, I had a lot of students who knew nursery rhymes and counting out rhymes again, so maybe this play movement has helped. That's good. Okay. Do you have a question?
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't know if you were telling me to stop. Do you have a question?
I have many, many questions, but let's see. I guess one question would be, because you've written a number of books and you've been doing this for a while, is there one or two things that you find you sort of have to struggle against as a writer, like that you have to not that you try not to let yourself do? Maybe that's too intimate of a question.
Well, I mean, the answer is yes. I mean, there are many things. I mean, and a lot of it is just unconscious. I was even aware when I was reading it today how certain words I tend to use over and over again. And if I notice them, I try to not use them for a while. But anybody has an unconscious stocked with such phrases. There's a certain kind of tone that I start to fall into, and I try to vary it by writing comic poems or writing other kinds of poems. So I just try to figure out what I haven't tried yet. You know, I grew up in the poetry world in a time where people were really interested in developing a unique and distinctive voice and being that voice, embodying it. The way, you know, many artists are under pressure to develop a kind of signature look. And I always knew that it just wouldn't be worth it. I mean, whatever would come from that wouldn't be worth it compared to the ability to just keep changing. So my greatest advice is also my greatest resource in that I love to keep changing my work. And I don't really fear making a big error with it too much, which is a way of not taking myself all that seriously, I suppose. But on another level, I'm very, very serious about that. I mean, that seems to be, to me, the more serious path to take. Okay. I also like to give advice, and I never expect anyone to take it. So, is that okay? Thanks.
This has been a presentation of the Kentucky Women Writers Conference and the University of Kentucky. Copyright 2010, all rights reserved.